This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast on your smartphone. Simply go to the podcast app and search for DC 37 State of the Union. You can check out our website, www.dc37.net. Follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can call our hotline, 212-815-7555, to stay abreast of DC 37 events. And if you have any comments about this show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. The District Council 37 Education Fund is a program that the union started back in 1971 to help members with their advance their education, both for career-related purposes and also to help folks be better educated. The Education Fund announced a new initiative last week, and here now to talk about that is Diallo Shabazz, who is the administrator of the DC 37 Education Fund. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Good to be back, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about what it is. I know that this initiative involves technology. It's a digital platform of sorts.
Absolutely. 21st century. We have to make it happen.
And it seems to be right on the cutting edge. So let's take it slow for people like myself, who sometimes have a hard time understanding what it is that we're talking about.
Right. Well, and usually when we're talking about technology, sometimes people are intimidated, because they think that it's going to require a level of sophistication, skills they don't have. But actually, the new digital badge initiative that we're launching is something that actually was suggested by members, over a year ago when we started restructuring the education fund. A number of members of DC 37 would call us and say, I'm applying for a new job and it requires me to have taken certain licensing requirements or have certain certifications or have gone to certain workshops. And I went to those workshops. You offered them 4 years ago. Can you send me a copy of my certificate? And you usually say, no, unfortunately, we can't. We're happy that you took the workshop.
And you should have kept your certificate.
You should have kept your certificate. It's hard for us to track these things down years later. And so the first idea we had was, is there a better way for us to help members track training that they've had over time? And also we started thinking about, is there a better way for us to help members share certificates and credentials that they've gotten? And so what we were able to do is partner with a company called Credly.com. Credly has a digital badge platform. And so what that means is if you are an architect who has taken a training course on bridge design, if you are a social worker who has taken a workshop on social-emotional learning, if you are a leader in a union and you've taken a shop steward class, we have a way for us to give you a digital version of that certificate that is verified by the place you got it from. And it goes right into your profile. You log in just like you log into Facebook or LinkedIn, and all the badges that you've accrued are there. And you can share these badges. You can put a link in your resume. In the same way that people upload a photo right now to Facebook or LinkedIn, these platforms already have a feature for you to upload your badges. So you can go in and see everything that you've earned along the way. So it's a way for you to verify not only what you've not only the courses that you've taken for yourself, but if you're going for a job interview or you're required to renew your certifications every so often or your licenses, it's a great for you to make sure way for you to make sure that you have everything in order.
So are you how is this being rolled out?
So what we've done is so we have 127,000 members of DC 37, in the technology world, they call that at scale. Okay. And you can't do something at scale immediately. You have to kind of pilot it a little bit at a time.
Absolutely.
So we're rolling out to a few thousand members at a time. What we're doing is we're starting with members who have recently taken courses with us, either at DC 37 or through one of our college partners. And so we have partnerships with a number of CUNY colleges in New York City in all five boroughs. And a number of members have taken a class with them before. And what we've done is talk to these colleges and say, is it possible for us to take the certificate that our members earned over the past few years that's still valid and give them a digital certificate for it and do that moving forward? And they said, yes, they've been a great partner. And so we've reached out to our architects, to our engineers, to our social workers. We reached out to a number of people who've taken leadership courses with us over the past few years. And we've said, these are all the courses that you've taken that are relevant for this. We're going to give you a digital badge for every single one of these. All you need to do is log in, give us your email address to update the information, and all of your badges will be there. And you can click on them and open them up, and it says exactly what you learned and what your skill sets are. It makes it very clear what competencies you've gained.
And you can share this, again, with perspective and as you're going for other job possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the, so there are two things that we do, really, at the Education Fund. I mean, it's education and training. I mean, the education is all about making sure that people are able to get additional, you know, their basic GED or college degrees. And the training is all about certifications so that you can be qualified in your current job, especially if skill requirements are changing. And also if there's another job that you want to go after in terms of a job promotion, that's what we do as well. And making sure that people, it's easy for them to access these credentials so they can prove to their employer that they've done these courses is important to make them viable as an employee.
And it's so simple, and it's brilliant in its simplicity, because the idea that you took a course 5 years ago and now you're looking around for the paperwork and where do I have it, and calling DC37, which is doing many other things, and trying to, because we can't archive these things for everybody.
Right. And it's good that in part is good that it's retrospective, you know, that it helps you kind of track things that you've had over time. But what's also important is from a career pathway standpoint, the question that anyone usually asks themselves is, where is my career going? You know, what's the next step for me and how do I get there? And one of the things that happens when you utilize digital badges is you're forced to really kind of lay out a roadmap of what the next skill set needs to be, what the next credential or certification needs to be. And so it allows you to see exactly where you need to go. We're using this particularly for a number of job titles at DC37. People work in some industries that are rapidly changing. In administrative assistant jobs, people who work in offices, you know, they do back office work, people who are accountants, et cetera. We know that a lot of that work is being automated. We know that now a computer can do the work that a human being used to do, even in an office. And so we're already receiving reports where people are saying that, you know, my colleagues retired or someone left to get a job and they didn't replace that position. So positions are being phased out. So if you're in one of those jobs, what are the next steps you need to take to make sure that you either remain relevant in your current job or you can transition to another job? And what we're also looking at is what kind of new jobs are being created on the horizon that public sector folks are going to be engaged in. Communication skills, talking to another human being, for the most part, no matter what anyone says about Siri, right, is still a job for human beings. Social workers are not going to be replaced anytime soon. Teachers are not going to be replaced anytime soon. And yet these people still need to retrain because the importance of utilizing technology in those jobs becomes more important. The importance of having better communication skills in those jobs is more important. And when people are taking communication analysis workshops or they're taking public speaking skills workshops, people tell me they're a great public speaker all the time. And it's hard to prove that unless you've actually seen them do public speaking. But if they can show you the courses that they've taken and you can read the badge that says, we learned these skills, I took these exams, it's verified by these institutions, it gives you a higher level of credibility to manage your own career.
And when we talk about the Education Fund, it's important to, you know, keep reemphasizing to members that these classes are available. And part of why it's always a pleasure to talk to you is that there's always a sense of, you know, what is happening out there in terms of the workforce. I hear these numbers that in the next 10 years, there's going to be a big change in the city workforce because of the number of people who are eligible to retire.
Yeah.
And what does that mean to the work that we're doing?
Yeah, I mean, conservatively, over the next decade, about a third of New York City's workforce is going to retire, probably higher than that. There are 400,000 employees that are part of New York City government. New DC 37 represents about a third of them, 127,000. It's a lot of people that are going to be moving on, and it's a lot of people to replace. There's a lot of institutional history. There are a lot of skill sets to be gained. Government isn't always the most efficient mechanism.
Right.
And so sometimes it becomes kind of challenging to come in and take over a piece of work. So there's a lot of opportunity there. Also, I think that society in general right now is putting a lot more emphasis on the importance of training workers. You know, for a long time during the 80s and the 1990s, a lot of companies scaled back in terms of training. You know, they outsourced training to different consulting companies. They moved work overseas. A lot of jobs themselves didn't really change. The technology didn't change that much. And so a lot of companies, they did away with their training divisions. And now at the dawn of the 21st century, when technology in a lot of industries is more important, when people are talking about the impact of, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning on the horizon, people need more training now than they have in a long time, and jobs are changing faster. You know, there's a statistic right now that if someone is a first-year computer science student in college, that by the time you reach your senior year, half of what you've learned is already obsolete. And so Amazing. If industries are changing so fast, how do you help people keep up? You have to train them. And so the city of New York has been investing a lot more money in training. They've actually been working with DC37. We signed our citywide contract, and that came along with an increase in funding for training.
It's a significant increase, and it's perhaps overdue.
It is definitely overdue.
To bring us up to speed where we can be a very potent player in terms of the provision of education and training.
Absolutely. You know, and another important thing is that you know, organizations can't do this on their own. There has to be a level of collaboration between labor unions, training organizations, colleges and universities, and government institutions. That type of collaboration is growing. We've been working very closely with a number of colleges and universities in New York City. CUNY has been a strong partner. Monroe College has been a very strong partner for a long time. And we're talking to them about what kind of training courses we should be offering to our members to prepare them for their current jobs and also make sure that they're ready for the future.
We're talking with Diallo Shabazz. He is the administrator of the DC37 Education Fund. To find out more about classes that are available and to find out more about training that is available, please check out the Education Fund on the DC37 website, www.dc37.net. And is there a number to call to?
Absolutely. Anyone who has any questions about who is a DC37 member and you have questions about your education benefits in terms of what courses are available and how you register, you can call our general number at any time. That number is 212-815-1700.
And fall courses will be available.
Absolutely. We do four course terms a year. Right now we're in the middle of our summer term. Not a whole lot of classes then because a lot of people are at the park with their family, at the beach, they're on vacation. But we do have some courses available then. Most of our classes take place in the fall, either in the winter term, which is usually at the beginning of the year, January to March, or in the spring term, April to June. So a number of different types of opportunities for people to register at a time that's convenient for them. Sometimes people say, I want to go back to school. I want to take additional courses, but I'm not sure what courses to take. I need help figuring this out. We have counselors available for free for members. You can call up. We'll schedule an appointment. And these are career counselors and education counselors who will talk to you about what job you're working with now, what you're interested in doing moving forward. We do testing on site so we can test your basic skills to see exactly where you are so you know, so we can put you into a course where you're set up to be successful. So these are great benefits that are provided to folks. I mean, a lot of companies aren't able to provide a robust training program for their staff because it costs so much. These are millions of dollars. But as a member of DC37, members are able to get this for free.
Diallo Shabazz is the administrator of the DC37 Education Fund. To find out more about the fund, check out the website www.dc37.net or call
212-815-1700.
Thanks for being here, Diallo.
Good to have you. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. We speak a lot on this show about the corrosive nature of politics in our country. And one of the reasons why politics is in such trouble in our country is the issue of money. My next guest is Kimberly Reed. She is the director of Dark Money, a political thriller that examines one of the greatest present threats to American democracy, the influence of untraceable corporate money on our elections and elected officials. It's a documentary. We're taping this on Thursday, July 12th. The film is opening in New York on Friday, July 13th. Welcome to State of the Union, Kimberly.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about how this movie came to be. Just tell us how this began.
Yeah, you know, I'm from I'm living in New York now for a long time, 18 years, but I'm from Montana. And I pay attention to the news, and I am, you know, aware of, because of that, Montana's long tradition of basically resisting corporate control of politics. Not a lot of people, I think, on the coast realize that a lot of the kind of early progressive movements started in the mines out west. And that is the tradition that I kind of grew up with. When you're in grade school in Montana, you learn the history of the Copper Kings, you know, industrialists, usually from New York City, moving out and trying to develop the copper mines. And, you know, at that time, about 100 years ago, the way to do it was to buy up the mines, buy up the newspapers, and then buy up all of the politicians. And I'm not like speaking metaphorically.
Right.
I'm talking literally. I'm talking about like people taking out ads in their own newspapers, promising politicians that they will pay them $10,000 for their vote. That was a kind of a famous case with William A. Clark, one of those Copper Kings, who, you know, gave people $10,000 in an envelope on the floor of the Montana legislature to make him the United States Senator from Montana. And that basically kind of cracked open a big, you know, corruption scheme that led to Montanans passing a ballot initiative in 1912. Saying we don't want any more of this corporate money in our politics. And that stood for about 100 years until Citizens United came along in 2010. And, you know, the Supreme Court decision that basically said that spending by corporations and unions and probably most importantly these days, individuals could be unlimited as long as it was done independently. And Montana, in a couple years after that, after Citizens United passed, Montana decided to stick with its own law because of its own situation that, you know, Montana had been through. You know, we've done this before, guys. We see that, you know, corporate money in politics has a corrupting effect, and we don't want to go back there. About half the states actually signed on to this case for Montana to defend its 100-year-old ballot initiative law that was called the Corrupt Practices Act. And that case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the film first started when that case was going there. I had been wondering how to tell the story of money and politics, which can be an abstract story. But when I saw that my home state, with, you know, which is a place where I knew a lot of the folks and positions that I would need to talk to, I would have great access. It was feasible to make a film there. I just realized, you know, hey, this is a good way to tell this story about money and politics, which is usually something that is so diffuse and abstract that nobody can ever really, you know, wrap their arms around the story.
And how much how difficult was it to make? How difficult was it to make this film?
You know, the hard part with telling these stories about money and politics is, you know, putting a human face on it.
Right. How'd you do
luckily,
that?
Luckily, well, you know, it's because of this. I think, again, you got a state that doesn't have a lot of people in it.
Right.
You got a state that's very rich in natural resources, so tends to get, you know, developed in air quotes of those natural resources. And if you have a citizenry that knows what the effects of that is and pays attention to it and tries to prevent it, you get a dramatic clash between these kind of two sides of the money and politics equation that you don't usually see. And I figured we might see it in Montana because people were just paying attention. The other thing that happened is just kind of jaw-dropping twists and turns that led to the revelation of some crucial documents that let us really connect all of the dots in this story about how that shell game of, you know, political influence really works by hiding the money coming from these dark money groups. You know, we just had some kind of wild revelations of, where we got our hands on this like crucial evidence so we could actually tell the story. And that evidence actually leads up into a big trial at the end of the film that, you know, becomes a dramatic and suspenseful narrative that we can follow. So,
and you're following a local journalist through. Go ahead.
The whole story is told through the eyes of a journalist, an investigative reporter, who's a longtime person following the political scene in Montana. He was a state house bureau chief there for the Gannett paper that was based there, and he just had his ear to the ground. He was following these issues. When I first met him, we were kind of doing the same thing. You know, I was covering this money and politics story from 30,000 feet, you know, and with this long view that documentary films have to have. And John Adams is his name. and no, I did not make that up.
Right.
A little bit on the nose there. But he was interested in following these stories really well on the ground. So at first we started just sort of commiserating, you know, we were just exchanging information and stories and contacts and stuff. But then at a certain point, I just realized that the story was so abstract that having him as sort of our, I kept telling him he was Virgil, taking us through the underworld of all this dark money stuff, that he was kind of our quasi narrator who was going to guide us through this and show how this scheme of hiding political influence really works.
Well, we're talking with Kimberly Reed. She is the director of Dark Money, a documentary that opens by the time you're listening to this. It will have opened in New York. And is it a national release, or is it going to be available for viewing by New Yorkers and who else?
So we're opening up in New York at IFC Center on Friday the 13th, and then expanding out nationwide from there. So, attending on opening weekend for actually any documentary film really helps amplify its whole national release, because all the other art house theaters that play films like these really look at the opening weekend in New York. But yeah, we expand out to, you know, LA and San Francisco and DC. We're going nationwide. And then we will have a broadcast later on this fall in the run up to the election.
And, you know, we've only got about a minute and a half left. And this is a terrible, I should have asked you this at the very start. How prevalent now would you say is dark money? This idea that you cannot tell who is spending what, where, to influence American elections?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the most frustrating things about making this film has been, you know, I've followed this film over three election cycles, right? So in 2012, you can see the loopholes be opened up and start to be exploited, right? Actually, going back to 2010, after Citizens United was passed. Then you can just predict that that same loophole was going to get exploited by somebody else, and the loophole was going to get bigger, and you could drive a bigger truck through it next time around. And the same thing happened in 14 and 16. And part of the reason we're releasing the film now and during a midterm election season is, you know, so that we can kind of flag this issue so more people can pay attention. But yeah, it is very prevalent now. It's pretty much de rigueur that if you're going to run a political campaign, that, you know, it's technically illegal for a campaign to start a super PAC and a dark money group, but that always happens. You know, that candidates usually end up with one super PAC that's pulling for them and one dark money group that's pulling for them, and then it has even become lately a process of kind of bouncing money back and forth between dark money groups, which don't have to disclose their donors, and super PACs, which do have to disclose their donors. But if a dark money group gives to a super PAC, then you can hide it again, right? So that's what a lot of folks are doing.
And the amount of it, the amount of this money is staggering. I mean, the amount of money it takes to run for a local office these days is a lot of money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are some solutions to it. And folks in New York City can benefit from a pioneering program that's a small donor matching fund. So local candidates can run for office and have any contribution to their campaign matched 6-to-1 by a public financing pool of money that is run by New York City. And that's a really good way of amplifying the voice of the everyday citizen. So, you know, candidates don't just have to talk to millionaires to fund their campaigns.
The film is called Dark Money. It opens in New York City on July 13th. Kimberly Reed is joining us. To find out more about the film, you can go to the website. Just quickly give me the website address for
Dark. Yeah, it's darkmoneyfilm.com. Lots of info on the upcoming screenings and outreach information there.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
That's all the time we've got on this week's show. To find out more about the issues impacting your community, you can attend a DC 37 Political Action Community Association meeting near you. You can call 212-815-1550. The Municipal Employees Legal Services reminds you that they provide legal representation to members who are applying for citizenship. For more information, call 212-815-1818. Remember, you have any comments about this show or any other show that you've heard, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I'm Chris Policano. Want to thank my guests, Kimberly Reed and Diallo Shabazz. Until next time, ciao.